Progress.
Thank you, colleagues. Welcome back. We are going to proceed with Advocate Bauer. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I want to go to the judgment at page 89 of the judgment. Paragraph 89. Right? And it basically says, in the executive summary of the report, it is recorded that Minister Gordhan, during his tenure as the former commissioner of SARS, established an intelligence unit in violation of South African prescripts. Reliance for this conclusion is specifically made with reference to the fact that the intelligence unit was confirmed by a SARS investigation report compiled by Advocate Sikakani. The panel in the Sikakani investigation concluded that the unit was established unlawfully, primarily on the basis that it was in breach of Section 3 of the NSI Act. And then what the court does is go down, there is an amendment to the Act, and it looks at the provision that would have been applicable at the time prior to the amendment. So in other words, at the time when the unit was alleged to have been established. And it basically says, if any law expressly or by implication requires any department of state other than the NIA or SASS to perform any function with regard to the security of the Republic or the combating of any threat to the security of the Republic, such law shall be deemed to empower such department to gather departmental intelligence and to evaluate, correlate, and interpret such intelligence for the purpose of discharging such function, provided that such Department of State shall not gather departmental intelligence of the Republic in a covert manner. And the court, in interpreting the law, and this is one of the areas in which we will argue the court's judgments are in binding, so when they interpret the laws. From a reading of the section, we are not persuaded that the unit contravened the provisions of the NSI Act for the following reasons. Section 3.1 did not impose a general prohibition on the gathering of intelligence. The prohibition only applied to those departments of the state that were required by law to perform functions with regard to the security of the Republic or the combating of any threat to the security of the Republic. SARS was not such a department and was not required by law to perform any functions with regard to state security. SARS was therefore not subject to the prohibition in Section 3.1. Secondly, Section 3.1 did not prohibit all covert intelligence gathering. It only prohibited the gathering of departmental intelligence in a covert manner. Departmental intelligence is defined in Section 1 of the NSI Act as intelligence about any threat or potential threat to the national security and stability of the Republic. The unit housed in SARS was never engaged in the gathering of intelligence of this kind, and its activities fell well beyond the scope of the prohibition contained in Section 3.1 of the NSI, because it was not in the business of gathering intelligence about threats or potential threats to the national security and stability of the Republic. The findings identified in the Sikakani report and the panel's interpretation of Section 3.1 of the NSI Act has since its publication been widely repudiated. Judge Nugent, who chaired the commission in 2018, criticized the view of the Sikakani report, namely that the unit was considered to be unlawful, and stated, and then the same paragraphs of the Nugent report is there, and in specifically paragraph 9, which we looked at earlier, Judge Nugent sets out why, whilst the National Strategic Intelligence Act prohibits the covert gathering of certain intelligence, that applies to intelligence concerning threats to the safety of the state, which hardly applies to intelligence relevant to collecting tax. So Judge Nugent is on all fours with what the full bench is now saying. In this regard, Judge Nugent referred to the legal opinion furnished by Trengrove and Numelo on 1 September 2015 to the former commissioner of SARS, and then the same list of items to which I referred earlier is set out in paragraph 93. Go down. Go down. Judge Nugent, with reference to the legal opinion and the Sikakani report, as well as the SARS advisory report chaired by Judge Gruen, concluded as follows regarding the lawfulness of the establishment of the unit. And then it quotes what he said in paragraph 11. The public protector inexplicably ignored the report of Nugent Commission in reaching her conclusions. The public protector simply ignored the apology and retraction of the adoption of the Sikakani's panel's finding of the SARS advisory board headed by retired Judge Frank Cohen, and also referred to by Judge Nugent in the excerpts quoted above. And then it refers to a court judgment where the court was likewise critical of the view adopted by the Sikakani report with reference to the Nugent Commission. Quoting further from the Nugent Commission report, saying that there was an onslaught upon those who managed SARS upon allegations once peddled to the Sunday Times to a beguiled public. And it quotes paragraph 28, to which we've already gone to. Go down. And then it says the Sikakani report had dire consequences, not only for existing activities at SARS, but also for those officials implicated by the report. Following this report, Mr. Muyani, the then Commissioner of SARS, removed several SARS officials from their positions. On behalf of Minister Kudani, it was submitted that the report had the effect of cutting SARS enforcement capabilities, and that it undermined SARS capabilities to ensure tax compliance by prominent politicians and underworld figures, and thus had the result of enabling in a large part the capture of SARS. It is clear from a careful reading of the Sikakani report that the authors deviated from the terms of reference, made factual findings about allegations concerning the so-called rogue unit without affording any opportunity to those implicated in the report. The Sikakani report also relied upon and entertained allegations made by the Sunday Times newspaper, which the Sunday Times later repudiated, admitted it was reporting fake news, and which it then subsequently apologized to those that baselessly pillared and defamed, including Minister Kudan and Pillay. There is no indication from the report that the public protector considered the public apology published in the Sunday Times regarding its role postulating what became the rogue unit narrative. In fact, the public protector, during a public interview on 31 January 2019 with Advocate Jay Govender of the OIGI, referred to the unit as the rogue unit and as a monster. She also publicly expressed a desire to defeat the monster. These comments unfortunately do little to allay the applicant's allegation that the public protector is biased, or at least subject to a reasonable perception of bias. We come back to this issue later in the judgment to do that. And so those are the parts of the judgment. And then go to paragraph 100, which deals with the act. The public protector's stubborn reliance on an erroneous interpretation of Section 3.1 of the NSI Act is not explained in the report. She does not engage with any of the legal arguments that are contrary to those expressed in the complaints and her own. At the very least, it was expected that the public protector would critically engage with views contrary to hers instead of simply repeating the conclusions reached in the Sikakani report in respect of the lawfulness of the unit. But in addition to the fact that the Sikakani report had been widely discredited, we can likewise find no factual or legal basis upon which it can be concluded that the establishment of the unit was unlawful. In as far as the public protector has placed any reliance on the contravention of Section 3.1 of the NSI Act, in arriving at the finding that the unit was unlawfully established, the conclusions are clearly wrong in law, irrational and unlawful. The public protector also concluded that the unit was established in violation of the Act because it was set up without the involvement of the NIA. But this is equally wrong in law. The NIA was not legally required to be involved in the establishment of the unit. The public protector's conclusion in respect of the apparent lack of involvement of the NIA in the establishment of the unit are therefore wrong in law, irrational and unlawful. The public protector in addition argues that in the report that the establishment of the unit is improper and in violation of Section 209 of the Constitution and therefore amounts to maladministration under the Constitution and an abuse of power. The court found that the interpretation of Section 209 of the Constitution is wrong in law and does not constitute the legal basis for a conclusion. On a plain reading of Section 209, it is clear that this section does not deal with the establishment of COVID information gathering units at all. Section 209.1 reads as follows. Any intelligence service other than an intelligence division of the Defense Force or Police Service. So if we take that section out, it says any intelligence service may be established only by the President as head of the National Executive and only in terms of national legislation. The court said this section regulates the establishment of intelligence services and is confined to the establishment of intelligence services dedicated to the protection of national security. It was, as already pointed out, never the aim of the unit to protect national security. The unit, in any event, was never an intelligence service in the first place. The focus of the unit was to investigate tax evasion, illicit trade, and organized crime with tax implications. The public protector's finding that Minister Gordhan had acted improperly and in violation of Section 209 of the Constitution, and that his conduct consequently amounted to maladministration, and in terms of Section 182.1 of the Constitution, and an abuse of power in terms of Section 4.2 of the Public Protector Act, is therefore not only wrong in law, but irrational and forced to be reviewed and set aside. Shepo, just go back up to the quotation of the Act. The NSI Act, the 2013 Act. Paragraph 90. And so the reason I'm taking you back to the Act, because it shows in the Act where the issue of national security comes about. And you see the Act very clearly says, if any law expressly or by implication requires any department of state other than the NIA or SSA to perform any function with regard to the security of the Republic. And so that's where the court's interpretation come into that it's involved with national security. If we then go to paragraph 205, Public Protector's flawed reasoning goes even further. The Public Protector starts off on the premise that the unit was engaged in illegal intelligence gathering, namely spying, wiretapping, generally doing the things that only an intelligence service, such as the NIA, SSA, was lawfully entitled to do. She finds that the unit was illegal from the outset by adopting a legally flawed finding of the Sikakani panel. Because the unit was illegally conceived, Sikakani panel said so, must have procured and used illegal clandestine equipment in the course of its illegal activities. That's the next step. But the court then says, but even the Sikakani report did not find equipment for wiretapping and interception. At paragraph 82 of this report, it was found that, however, as a general rule, it was accepted that the unit did not have the required equipment to carry out such electronic surveillance or interceptions. If we go to 215. The Public Protector dismisses the denial of Mr. Gordhan on the basis that it is improbable that he could not have known about an illegal unit and relies on the Sikakani report and the Jean Revelle report that confirmed the participation of Minister Kudan in the recruitment of employees. Apart from the fact, as already pointed out, that any reliance on the discredited Sikakani report is irrational, the public protector on the one hand relies on Mr. Revelle's evidence when it supports the findings on the employment issue, but on the other hand states that his evidence before the Nugent Commission in relation to the lawfulness of the unit, which does not support the findings, was irrelevant and not binding on her. This is a clear example of the public protector's fallacious approach to the evidence and is indicative of the mindset with which she approached the investigation. Go to paragraph 290. But let me just read it. It's a quick paragraph. One of the conclusions that the court reaches and takes into account, and it contributes, it's 290, in respect of its conclusion that the public protector could only have come to such conclusions because she was biased, is the reliance on the discredited KPMG report, despite it having been disavowed, and the Sikakani report, despite it having been widely discredited. She also failed to engage with the findings made in the Nugent report. And that's at number 3 that you see that. And there's a list of 9 items on that list of bias that we will deal with at different times to show the committee what the affidavits say and what the court says. We then turn to the issue of the Kroon apology. She will go back to the affidavit in response to the subpoena at page, it starts at 216, volume 3. Yeah, actually, I want to go to 2. Sorry, go to page 234. It's the LA affidavit in volume 3, number 4. Now, just but go down. Just click on the bookmarks quickly. Right, go down to volume 3. Are you in volume 3? PG 10 at the bottom. Right, so there's 2216 in the document. So go to paragraph 23, it's 232. So you see at 31.7.8, they refer to the apology which was recorded in Judge Nugent's testimony to which I showed you earlier. And then if you go to, apart from the apology that was rendered, if you go to 31.7.10, is Mr. Pillay's submission about a subsequent admission by the retired Judge Kroon under oath in March 2019 that all the members of the so-called Kroon Advisory Board had deliberated the statement between May to June 2015 that the unit was unlawfully established as put forward by the so-called Sikakani panel, and that the board had then concluded that it was indeed wrong to have concluded this. And he says to the public protector, these facts can be determined from retired Judge Kroon and the members of the board directly. Now, when we deal with closing argument or when we question the public protector, we know that the Mail and Guardian route was not followed in respect of the Kudan investigation because we've had the evidence of Ms. Mvuyana in that regard, and we would need to confirm that indeed this was not followed up on. Right. If we look at the public protector's affidavit in response to the section 7(9), you will see that these are repeated. If you go to page 318, you've got to go to the next document. Just go to the bookmark. Right, and you go to click on PG 10 in volume 4. That's 301. You must go to 324. 90. Right. So if you see that again in his affidavit, Mr. Pillay says the same thing. He refers to the testimony of Judge Kroon, the apologies rendered by Judge Kroon. And then 90.4, he refers to what he calls the entire board's reconsidering the notion that the law unit was unlawfully established to do that. And then if you go to PDF 1517, if you go further down to 126.1.3, first looks at the Sikakani report, and he then goes to the KPMG part, he goes to the Kroon part, and he says it again there in doing it. All right. And if you look at what he said at page 624, and if you go down the page to up down on the page. Hold on, we've messed it up now. Go back to volume 11. Yeah. PG 31. And that is the affidavit in which Minister Godan responds to the section 7(9) notice served on him. Right? Yep. Right. And if you go down to paragraph 43.2, you will see that Minister Godan in the same way says to the public protector that the SARS advisory board chaired by Judge Kroon, who also initially endorsed the Sikakani conclusion at the time. Judge Kroon, however, recently recanted this endorsement in his evidence before the Newson Commission. He conceded that there was no reason to contend that the unit had been unlawfully established. He had apologized, and he refers to media reports. He then, whilst we're there, you might as well just look at the next. He too refers to the Nugent Commission in paragraph 11 of that report. And then he concludes with paragraph 44. The public protector does not engage at all with any of these views, which are contrary to our own. She simply ignores them and makes a contrary finding with no cognizable reason. In other words, why is she right and they are wrong? The inference is irresistible that she is willfully blinded by a determination to make an adverse finding regardless of verifiable facts. We know that if you go to 256, which would be in the public protector's report, paragraph 5.25 is the only reference to Kroon, right? And in doing that, it is the quotation that is taken from the Nugent Commission report. And if you go further up, 5.10 and 5.11, you will see that it is quoted from the SARS response that is handed in. So it's not part of the evaluation of evidence. It's part of the submissions that come from SARS. And then if you go back to the document we were on, and let's see what the litigation had to say about the, I think it's page 37, the evidence from different reports. Right, so go down, further down. Got to go past all of that. Just click on page 37. Right. So we go back to the affidavits we looked at under part A, and we again see that in respect of the Kroon affirmance, the public protector, go further down in the affidavit, said that she would not be dealing with these allegations as part of part A. So, and we see the allegations made at paragraph 57, that the advisory board chaired had initially endorsed the legally flawed interpretation, that Judge Kroon recanted this endorsement in his evidence for the Nugent Commission, and he conceded there was no reason to do that. So that he said before the court, and then the apology is detailed in paragraph 99. And if you go across the column, then you see in paragraph 16, Mr. Pillay refers to the affidavits that he had filed in the matter in which he raised that. And if you go down, you see that he confirms the truth of his affidavits in every respect, and he stands by the contentions of law set out therein, and he would amplify that in due regard. So now we come to part B. And we see that in respect of 86, you see in the reply, Minister Gordhan, we have already looked at the same averments early on in respect of the public protector's answering affidavit. In the reply, Minister Gordhan says it is unclear how she could deem it unnecessary to interview both Mr. Revelle and Judge Kroon when there were two key witnesses at the Nugent Commission on this very issue. And that's a response, if you go down. That was the point taken the public protector simply denies that the SARS advisory panel endorsed the legally flawed interpretation, and she expresses great concern that the judge would behave as Judge Gruen did, and the circumstances that forced him to recant are not yet known. It doesn't appear she made any, as if there was an endeavor to interview Judge Gruen in any way. If we go to paragraph 101, the public protector simply repeats the averments is there that she's not bound by the findings of the Nugent Commission or the recanted position of Judge Craig. When it comes to the supplementary affidavit, the point is taken. This must be viewed in conjunction with the recanted findings of both the Gruen Advisory Panel and the KPMG report. Both bodies have renounced the initial statements and the unit was unlawful and have publicly apologized to those affected. Public Protector says, to my knowledge, it is only just Judge Gruen who recanted. It was his view and not that of the panel. I am not aware of the panel having accepted the Gruen position on the findings of the advisory panel. The record does not, the minister says the record does not contain any evidence that the public protector took steps to interview Mr. Revelle and Judge Gruen or assess the evidence in full against as given again before the Nugent Commission. And the answer is it is presumptuous to suggest that the public protector did not take steps to verify the authenticity of the documents that she relied on. Mr. Godin provides no evidence of any documents that turned out to be, I think, probably means not authentic. His view that I should have considered newspaper articles and media commentaries and private individuals to perform my functions cannot be taken seriously. To the contrary, the public protector verified the documents that she considered, according to them, the weight necessary to come to the findings and conclusions that she came to. There was no need to interview Mr. Revelle and Judge Gruen for the purposes of deciding on the lawfulness of establishing a spying unit within SARS. And then I've already pointed out that in respect of the Pillay founding affidavit, the allegations that followed were not responded to. And if you go to further down, subsequent admission by Judge Gruen under oath, and then it records that the Gruen Advisory Board had deliberated the statement between May to June 2015 that the unit was unlawfully established as put forward by the so-called Sika Kani panel, and that allegation is not disputed on the affidavit before the court. And then the allegations that followed repeat very much the ones that have appeared in the previous affidavits. With respect to the apology, go right down, Shepel. And you see, if you go down to the bottom, in 96.4, same averment is made again, and it's not challenged. And then in paragraph 108.5, it recorded what the board had previously done, etc. And if you go to the judgment, I think I've encapsulated, just stay there, three paragraphs of the judgment are there. This is what the court said. The public protector inexplicably ignored the report of the Nugent Commission in reaching her conclusions. The public protector similarly ignored the apology and the retraction of the adoption of the Sika Kani panel's finding by the SARS advisory board headed by retired Judge Frank Gruen and also referred to by Judge Nugent in the excerpt quoted. Mr. Pillay submitted in particular the Sika Kani panel, a Crown advisory board, the KPMG process. The process is conducted by advocates Martin Prassi, Nadine Fourie and Mike Van Assen, attorneys Mashiana, Moodley and Munama, as well as multiple investigations conducted by the Hawks and NBA since 2014 to date, as well as the OIG report, have all fallen victim to the perpetuation of a false rogue unit narrative to some extent or another. He submitted that this is particularly so because they all, as a rule, fail to hear those they pronounce upon meaningfully at all, fail to provide any right to reply before making conclusions, findings, recommendations, and cherry-pick the twisted little truths mixed with a great deal of fiction. At 184, the court concluded the public protector had further failed to reflect on material and relevant events, facts, and evidence relating to the Crown Advisory Board. Mr. Pele particularly referred to the testimony by Judge Crown before the Nugent Commission, which specifically impacted on the intended or provisional findings in the notice. He referred to the formal apology that had been rendered, and the public protector and concluded that the public protector failed to consider the fact that some after 28 April 2015 for the period May to June 2015, the entire board reconsidered the notion that the unit was unlawfully established and concluded that they should not have made this finding after all, but never informed the public. That was undisputed on the papers before the court, as I showed you earlier on. And so the court concludes at 289, we conclude that taking into account the following, a conclusion of bias is warranted, the public protector completely disregard of the Sunday apology and the Crown apology. So we turn to the KPMG and we go back, Shepa, go back to the second 216, go to page. PG10. Volumes, yeah, 3. So it's number 4 still. Yeah, yeah. I just want to go to paragraph 24 of the document. So go up. Or up to 24. Right. So this is, again, we're back at Mr. Pillay's affidavit in response to the subpoena. Just go up to the top. Let me just make sure which affidavit we in. I don't want to misrepresent. Yeah, that's what I saw. So what we're looking at is go to paragraph 24. This is the response to the section 7(9) notice. Right? And in paragraph 24, you see that the public, what Mr. Pele does is he records that for purposes of the section 7(9) notice, the public protector claims to have relied on and considered the following evidence. Information and documents provided by whistleblowers and the complainants. And the point is taken, but the notice does not reflect on the evidentiary value, authenticity, accuracy, or context of these materials. Right? Documents previously provided by SARS, which are not fully identified or listed. An undated and unidentified document that is provided at 14.2.19 of the notice. an undated and undescribed document entitled Jean Revelle Dossier, which Mr. Pillay says he wasn't provided with. An undated and undescribed submission as set out in paragraph 14.4.27. Undescribed purported evidence pertaining to an application to an internal position in SARS by Mr. Van Lochenberg on 13 January 1999, almost 20 years ago. A memorandum of understanding between SARS and the National Intelligence Agency dated 2002. Confirmation by the IGI dated 31-2019 of the existence of a unit at SARS and that it was investigated by the IGI as contained in a report dated 31 October 2004, of which the public protector is seeking a copy. I record in this regard that this report has never been provided to me and I never participated in the process as an interviewee. The SARS recruitment and selection policy 2007, internal SARS emails, some SARS memorandum. A submission to the Minister of Intelligence, some more SARS memorandum, undescribed purported evidence pertaining to an application by Mr. Van Lochenberg on 2007, undescribed further evidence 2008. An informal SARS document which the public protector claims to be dated 14th May entitled Rules of Play. And the correct date was 11th April. The SARS Bid Adjudication Committee minutes, 23 February 2009, procurement request by ICAS. Cabinet approval dated 15th April. A SARS data dated 8th May. Internal SARS transfer. Procurement request by the SARS CAS division, a complaint by Mr. Kaletso Bizoski Maniki, dated 2004, in which he claims to have been a member of SARS Customs Border Control Unit, as well as the SPU NRG HRIU. A 5 May 2014 procurement request by ICAS, a SARS memoranda, SARS response to the previous public protector under Mr. Pillay's hands dated 26 August. And that is the document which Mr. Pillay referred to previously as being the comprehensive response which he had submitted to Advocate Madonsela. And then he notes that the public protector does not refer to the reply they took. 25 September 2014, procurement request by ICAS, further bid adjudication documents. And then he says the Sikakani report. And then he says he provided the public protector his legal critique dated December 2014, which had not been referred to, disputed, or even mentioned in the notice. A KPMG report dated 4 December 2015 that had not been provided to him to date. Another KPMG report that had not been provided to him to date. A procurement request by ICAS. Go down. Right. And then he lists further documents, interviews, and in 2439, you see that there's an alleged recording between the SARS, former SARS commissioner, Tom Moyani, and Andries Janssen van Rienburg, which is undated, which Mr. Pillay says he's never been provided with. A recording with Mr. Moyani and Messrs. Albert Lombard and Johan de Waal, which is undated. An undated submission to the public protector by Mr. Kaletso Maniki. And then an affidavit by Mr. Magashula. Affidavit by Mr. Pillay. An affidavit by Mr. Godan. Godan. And then Mr. Pillay says, in regard to the evidence in inverted commas relied on by the public protector for findings, I reiterate what he had previously stated, which I had taken you to earlier on about the difference between evidence and information. The process adopted by the public protector, which involves me having to defend myself against what may or may not emerge out of this evidence without any opportunity whatsoever to consider, contextualize, or challenge it, is the epitome of unfairness. And I want to take you to paragraph 73 of the affidavit. You've gone past. This is where again there is mention to the KPMG South Africa and the Judge Frank Kroon, who have both later effectively repudiated the findings. None have ever responded to the factual, procedural, and legal flaws in their work, nor the refusal of due process and the basic principle of ad alteram partem of those they pronounced upon in order to defend their work funded by taxpayers. Many involved in these processes have remained silent in the face of legitimate questions about their roles and participations and work at the time. And then he says it was at this time that state capture of state institutions were in full swing. Go to paragraph 85. Any reliance on the so-called KPMG report is irrational and in place. This is because it was admitted by KPMG South Africa to be a mere documentary review, which included limitations. Neither I nor anybody else implicated was afforded a hearing or right to reply. The report has been contested as profoundly flawed in fact and in law in many ways by many people in many platforms, amongst others with KPMG South Africa, SARS and Parliament. The report contains a disclaimer of a nature that states it can neither be referred to nor used in any dispute or controversy. Findings, conclusions, and recommendations have been formally withdrawn. KPMG's head of forensics, Mr. Roy Waligora, has testified before Parliament and under oath before a panel instituted by the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants that the person who compiled the report was lazy and unprofessional, and the report was influenced by outside parties and a result of copy-paste work. The complete fee for services rendered to SARS on an amount of 23 million was repaid to SARS, effectively repudiated the entire report. KPMG South Africa and KPMG International on their behalf have publicly apologized to South Africa, inter alia stating sorry, and we know sorry will never be enough. I, among others, have privately received an apology from KPMG South Africa in this regard. The report has no value whatsoever. And then he says, furthermore, I place the following on record in regard to the KPMG report. The KPMG report seems, for reasons unknown to me, to only reflect upon me, Messrs. Richer, Yolisa Pikki, Van Lochenberg, and the unit described as the subjects of the investigation. For some further unknown reason, the now withdrawn findings and recommendations also sought to drag former finance minister, Mr. Praveen Gordhan, into the fray. One version of the report, again for unknown reasons, also appears to have sought to implicate former minister of intelligence, Mr. Ronnie Castles. What exactly informed the specific focus on these particular individuals and the scope and terms of reference are unknown to me. In essence, the KPMG report contains significant and material factual errors, omits material and relevant facts, makes misrepresentation of facts, makes facile comments and statements, shoehorns information to suit the narrative of a rogue unit, conceals or omits evidence and facts of serious criminality, seeks to rely on Kanyana and Sikakani panel reports, but fails to reflect on the factual inaccuracies, contradictions, omissions, and flaws, instead seeking to rely on selective aspects thereof. Is unfair and untruthful and lacks integrity. Uses loose language and makes flawed assumptions that are unsubstantiated and unsupported by any evidence, in some cases false and defamatory and or wrongly attributed, cases using sweeping phrases such as it may be, could be, possibly, we understand to be, may have, there is reason to believe, and so forth. Ignored exculpatory facts and evidence, ignored publicly available facts and evidence that contradicts the content, ignored basic facts which could have easily been obtained and which are material to the topics it expresses views on, and followed a legally questionable process to compile and publish the report. further. I also specifically refer to the obligation which rested on KPMG South Africa to report evidence in terms of Section 34 of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act and the failure to do so being a criminal offence. KPMG not only failed to adhere to this, but in my view, concealed evidence and ignored it deliberately. And then it says KPMG did not declare the patent conflicts of interest in relation to the role of Ms. Belinda Walter as service provider to them, both as attorney for Stain Kenya Inc. and later in 2013 as Belinda Walter attorneys, nor a role as a secret agent for British American Tobacco, of which KPMG is the external auditor, and in as much as this was most relevant to their brief. The report ignores the basic tenets of natural justice, the fundamental right of reply before being judged, and does not reflect on the views and the responses of those that pronounce judgments upon. I was always maintained and stated so in writing that KPMG South Africa heard me and others they pronounced upon they would not have made the adverse comments that they did. As with the Sikakani panel process, I do not only take issue with the content of the report, but also with what is not contained in the report. Even at the most basic level of simple facts, the report is factually wrong. It does not reflect upon material and exculpatory facts and acts of serious criminality, the disruption of state institutions and actions, and the manipulation of state officials and their offices. I'm astounded as to how the allegations kept on morphing over time and how these were not dealt with by KPMG. The initial allegations against the SARS unit, which commenced in the media from 12 October 2014 onwards, were that they had broken into homes, conducted house infiltrations, broken into President Zuma's home, planted listening devices there, were involved in the deaths of former SARS officials, used secret funds of over 560 million, bought new homes and cars, conducted lifestyle audits on prominent politicians, infiltrated politicians as bodyguards, spied on top cops and the late former National Police Commissioner Jackie Selebi, spied on President Zuma and another at the Beverly Hills Hotel in Durban, entered into dodgy settlements with taxpayers, wanted to swing elections, owned and used a so-called grabber, operated the brothel as a front, used the fundraising initiative for charities as a front, operated front companies, were deployed to destroy careers of SARS officials, purchased sophisticated spying software, and used this intercepted taxpayers' telecommunications and emails and so forth. I find it no coincidence that the report failed to reflect on most of these allegations in any meaningful way. Instead, only a few of these allegations are briefly mentioned and not properly dealt with. Loose language again is used to refer to some aspects only, but none are dealt with in the manner one would expect of a firm such as KPMG. The report introduces concepts foreign to me, such as a virtual unit and unit by association. These are simply figments of a creative imagination. I believe it would have been reasonable to expect of KPMG in a process of which cost the taxpayer $23 million with such serious consequences to act independently, fairly, and with integrity, to list all of the allegations and then reflect upon each and every one, either confirming them or disproving them or expressing some sort of definitive view on them. Those not confirmed should then cause KPMG to reflect upon what exactly led to these being bandied about with wanton abandon in the media. It begs the question, if none of these allegations are true, who were the people behind these allegations? Why did they leak it to the media? For whose benefit and to what end? The KPMG report is silent on all of this. I believe firmly that the language and style of both the Sikakani panel report and the KPMG report, notably the use of loose language, sweeping allegations, and unsubstantiated conclusions and contents is not dissimilar to the language and style of the notice. From the notice, it is further apparent that the public protector had failed to reflect on material and relevant events, facts, and evidence relating to the so-called Kroon Advisory Board, in particularly, and then a number are listed thereafter. Go to paragraph 98. However, when this continually changing allegation and all the others up to this point were found to hold no water, the allegation morphed yet again in an even more vague fashion by way of the leaked KPMG report, which I have already dealt with above. In the KPMG's report, now repudiated and withdrawn, conclusions, findings, and recommendations, the statement was made that the unit was established in contravention with the rule of law, with no legal explanation or setting out as to why this was so. Paragraph 126.1.2. The KPMG report is profoundly flawed in fact and law and cannot be relied on for any purpose. Its findings have been repudiated and withdrawn. The full fees replayed. And then it says, furthermore, its disclaimer, as contained in the leaked version, renders it useless for the purposes for which the public protector seeks to use it. The disclaimer states in no uncertain terms that the KPMG report may not be provided to any third party, may not be used in draft, may not be used in part, may not be used in final, may not be used in portion thereof, cannot be relied upon for resolution of any dispute, cannot be relied upon for disposition of any dispute, cannot be disclosed in whole, cannot be disclosed in part, cannot be quoted in whole, cannot be quoted in part, cannot be referenced in whole, cannot be referenced in part, cannot be disclosed unless written approval is obtained from KPMG for purposes not described, and was not intended for the express or implied benefit of any third party. But paragraph 143. Mr. Pillay then reiterates, I have already set out why the KPMG report cannot be used for purposes and relied on. And then he repeats all of that. And he doesn't say anything different other than that it's been the many platforms in which it was raised there. And then he reiterates at 1.43.2, summarizes up the disclaimer. The fact that its findings, conclusions, and recommendations have been withdrawn, that the fees have been returned in three, and then go to paragraph 163. And then he says that 163.2. KPMG appears to seek to impute or suggest or allege that the specific unit in question acquired and or used sophisticated surveillance equipment. The content of the leaked draft report, however, provides no evidence or substantiation or support for this contention. The heading and the content of the paragraph are incongruent of each other and misleading and deceiving of the reader. It is telling that the finding in a block on page 104 of the draft report leaked to the media states, the unit and SARS during the period made inquiries, acquired, and were offered equipment regarded as listed equipment during the period 2006 and 2014. From paragraph 7.11.2 to 7.11.9 on pages 105 to 108, certain equipment is listed and described. But in no instance is there any substance or supporting evidence provided in the report that proves that the unit in question acquired such equipment and used it. KPMG does not say so and does not demonstrate how the equipment was supposed to have been used by the unit. The equipment referred to was most likely that which was acquired by the SARS ACAS, which is a completely different unit. The public protector has not considered purchase orders, order requisitions, asset registers, and proof of payment and signatories to these documents, along with the cost center analysis and determination showing which unit in SARS paid for and controlled the equipment. These documents are easily accessible by the public protector. To the reader of the leaked KPMG report, at first glance, it would seem that the unit in question acquired surveillance equipment. On closer scrutiny, though, the content of the leaked draft of the KPMG report does not state so as a fact. The KPMG report deceitfully uses the term the unit and SARS interchangeably, which is deliberately misleading. KPMG does not state, nor does KPMG emphatically provide evidence of any kind that the unit in question obtained and used surveillance equipment in any manner or for any purpose, let alone unlawfully or illegally sold. The reference to and reliance by the public protector in the notice to the statement by KMG that the possibility cannot be excluded that the equipment and software was available to them is mischievous. No evidence has been provided either by KPMG or the public protector to back up this entirely speculative conjecture. He then, with reference to certain further paragraphs, says, the matters recorded in these paragraphs relate to a completely different unit that existed at SARS, and this has got to do with the equipment that had been obtained, and have absolutely nothing to do with the unit in question in any manner or form. To do that. And then at 164.3, he records that none of the equipment in relation to any of the documents listed are capable of interception of communication. All are commercially available and commonly in use by multiple government departments and corporate companies, as well as private investigators, companies, and journalists. The purpose was solely intended to assist the unit overseen by Mr. Clifford Collins, namely the ACAS, to safeguard SARS property assets, officials, records, facilitate security at ports of entry and warehouses under control of SARS, and conducting anti-corruption investigations within SARS. This has absolutely nothing to do with the then disbanded unit. And Shepo, then go back to the judgment. I mean, not the judgment. The affidavit. Now go back to the document that says evidence from different reports. It would be roughly page 53. So scroll down. We'll see the table coming up. So again, as we did before, we looked at the part A of the affidavit in which the allegations were contained, and the references made to the KPMG report and the withdrawal of the report. And the point is made that in the KPMG report stated that neither go down. That neither the SARS Act nor the Tax Administration Act recognize SARS as a law enforcement agency and does not vest its employees with the powers of enforcement officers. And at paragraph 12.1.2, the KPMG report under heading said executive findings and conclusions records that under the guidance of Pillay, COVID and Rogue Intelligence Unit in contravention of the rule of law was established by SARS. So again, the approach of the public protector is I'm only dealing with allegations relating to part A. I'm not going to be able to deal with the allegations. I'm not dealing with the allegations relating to the substance of the review in dealing with that. In the replying affidavit from Minister Kudan, there's no mention of KPMG, and we know that Mr. Pillay's affidavit supports the relief sought by Minister Kudan in that regard. So we know, if you go down, there's reference and acknowledgement from what KPMG precisely did, and Mr. Pillay dealt with it in these affidavits, effectively putting out the submissions from KPMG to which we referred. And then you see in Annexure PG15, which is out of place actually because it deals with the Kroon report. I need to put it up. Is the media articles in which it stated that the panel had revisited it and discussed it, and it was concluded that we should not have made the statement. If you go down further to the document, you see the KPMG retraction. SARS report refers to legal opinions, illegal conclusions, as if they are opinions of KPMG South Africa. However, providing legal advice and expressing legal opinions was outside the mandate of KPMG South Africa and outside the professional expertise of those working on the engagement. KPMG South Africa acknowledges that such opinions should have been caveated as recommendations of legal advisors are not formulated in the manner contained in the report. And then they say, as a result, it is possible to read certain sections of the executive findings and conclusions contained in the report in a way which suggests that Minister Kodan knew or ought to have known of the establishment of SARS of an intelligence unit in contravention of the rule of law that was rogue in nature. This was not the intended interpretation of the report to declare the evidence in the documentation provided to KPMG South Africa does not support the interpretation that Mr. Kodan knew or ought to have known of a rogue unit of this nature, of a rogue nature of this unit. If we then look at what the public protector answered to the Kodan founding affidavit, and you see that in answering to the three paragraphs, it says the prevarication of an organization on its work would be unhelpful to anyone serious about pursuing constitutional truths. The KPMG report is irrelevant as a source of Mr. Kodan's review application. I was not bound by the positions of the KPMG. She acted independently, impartially, with dignity and effectively. All right. So that's the response to 103 to 105. In total. And then if you go to the supplementary founding affidavit, just the next page. Go down. The public protector says the KPMG report is irrelevant as the source of Minister Kodan's review application. I was not bound by the position of KPMG. And then the minister says the following people and bodies have investigated the same issues. And then points out that KPMG had renounced the initial statements, was unlawful, and have publicly apologized to that effect. And the PP says the KPMG report raises issues that must concern any self-respecting institution of government. To simply accept the recantation without more is scandalous. It is for this reason that the public protector was entitled to investigate the complaints about SARS, especially because it appeared that there was a cover-up by forensic investigations. Millions of rands were spent by Justice Kroon and the KPMG to conduct work relevant to the functioning of SARS. Mr. Kodan does not appear perturbed by the astronomical financial and personal resources that were deployed by government to conduct investigations in which those who did so recanted on their findings. The clearest sign that there was a cause for concern to justify the public protector's decision to conduct an investigation into the allegations involving SARS is this conduct of the Kroon Advisory Panel and the KPMG. It is simply opportunistic for Mr. Kodan to rely on the renunciation of these reports as proof that the public protector should not have investigated the issues. One would assume that the conduct of the Kroon Advisory Panel and KPMG should not concern anyone, including the public protector. Further, in any event, the public protector was not bound by conduct apologies of the Kroon Advisory Panel and KPMG. The public protector is a constitutional body with a responsibility to the South African public to investigate and report on activities of government bodies, and points out that those bodies have no constitutional mandate at all. Their work could never be binding on the public protector, and the suggestion that they could have is naive and irresponsible, coming as they do from a member of cabinet with special constitutional duties. Minister Gordhan then says it is evident that these facts were ignored by the public protector since they do not appear in the record, and that the entire legal reasoning is based on the opinion of the Sikakani panel on the lawfulness of the establishment of the SARS investigative unit, which is widely considered to be incorrect. And then the answer is the public protector is not bound by the findings of the current advisory panel, and that's an abbreviation for the Nugent Commission. The public protector has irrevocable constitutional qualities, which includes independent, performing its duties impartially and exercising powers and functions without fear, favor, or prejudice. Just to emphasize, those things are then set out again to do that. And then with reference to the Pillay founding affidavit, these allegations were again not responded to. And if you go down, you'll see it largely repeats what I've already drawn your attention to and read to you from these affidavits. If you go down, Chepo, past paragraphs 94 that we've already dealt with. And you go to the judgment at the bottom that says full bench. Yeah. Now we've dealt with those averments earlier. The second report relied upon by the public protector is a report compiled by the audit firm KPMG for the erstwhile SARS Commissioner, Mr. Muyani. In the report, the public protector relies on the findings made in the KPMG, particularly with reference to the unit's operations. Reference is made in the report to the fact that the KPMG report has found that there was clear evidence that the unit intercepted private individual communication and that members of the unit were not employed by SARS, but they were recruited outside of SARS, acknowledged systems and processes. Apart from the findings in respect of the activities of the unit, the key finding in the KPMG report is that Minister Gordhan knew or ought to have known not only that the establishment of by SARS of an intelligence unit was in contravention of the law, but that the unit was rogue in nature. What the public protector does not record in the report is the fact that on 16 September 2017, long before the public protector delivered the report, KPMG had disavowed its own report and particularly its conclusions regarding the lawfulness of the unit. Not only did KPMG tender an apology for its governance lapses, it refunded the fees it had received for its report. KPMG has since admitted that important quality controls were not performed to the standard of the firm. KPMG also acknowledged that insofar as the report refers to legal opinions and legal conclusions, as if they are the opinions of KPMG South Africa, it was outside the mandate of KPMG South Africa and outside the professional expertise of those working on the engagement. KPMG then concedes that the language used in sections of the report is unclear and results in certain findings being open to more than one interpretation. As a result, it is possible to read certain sections contained in the report in a way that suggests that Pravin Gordhan knew or ought to have known of the establishment by SARS of an intelligence unit in contravention of the law that was rogue in nature. And then it said, this was not the intended interpretation of the report. To be clear, the evidence in the documentation provided to KPMG South Africa does not support the interpretation that Mr. Gordhan knew or ought to have known of the rogue nature of this unit. We recognize and regret the impact that this has had. KPMG South Africa had no political motivation or intent to mislead. Given the failure to appropriately apply our own risk management and quality controls, that part of the report which refers to conclusions, recommendations, and legal opinion should no longer be relied upon. KPMG South Africa has contacted SARS and offered to repay the 23 million fee received for the extensive work performed. So the court says the KPMG report is flawed in fact and in law, and its findings and conclusions have been formally withdrawn. Any reliance by the public protector of the KPMG report was under the circumstances irrational and ill-based. Mr. Pillay also warned the public protector that any reliance on the KPMG report would be irrational and ill-based because it was admitted by KPMG South Africa to be a mere documentary review which included limitations and had no value whatsoever. Mr. Pillay contended that in addition, none of the people implicated in the KPMG report were afforded a hearing or right of reply, and the report had been contested as profoundly flawed in fact and in law in many ways by many people in many platforms, amongst others by KPMG South Africa, SARS and Parliament. Moreover, its findings and conclusions and recommendations have been formally withdrawn. Mr. Pillay stated that he had even privately received an apology from KPMG South Africa in this regard. Mr. Pillay described how the rogue narrative was perpetuated by these reports, while those affected by these reports had never seen them, were never afforded a right to reply, and were banned by former SARS Commissioner Mr. Tom Oyani from defending SARS, its officials, and themselves from this public onslaught. He stated that having read the notice, he was firmly of the view that the public protector was merely advancing the same false rogue unit narrative, and the ever-changing, continuing attempt to make something stick to the unit was malicious and capricious and clearly intended to keep the narrative alive for ulterior purposes. The KPMG report appears to suggest that the specific unit in question acquired and or used sophisticated surveillance equipment. Mr. Pillay sets out in his first affidavit, while the KPMG report provides no evidence or substantiation for this contention. On closer inspection of the report from paragraph 711.2 to 711.9, on pages 5105 to 508 of the KPMG report, certain equipment is listed and described, but no evidence is provided that it was the unit that acquired such equipment and used it. The reference to and reliance by the public protector in the notice to the statement by KPMG that the possibility cannot be excluded that the equipment and software was available to them is mischievous. We conclude that taking into account the following, a conclusion of bias is warranted. The reliance on the discredited KPMG report, despite it having been disavowed, and the Sikakane report, despite it having been widely discredited, she also failed to engage with the findings made in the Nugent report. Now, we know that the full bench then found against the public protector, and there was then an application for leave to appeal, which was lodged thereafter. And Shepa, go to the bundle E8.3. Bundle 8, bundle E, I think, yep, 5. So this, you'll see from page 2, is that the public protector seeks leave to appeal to the SCA against the whole of the judgment and order handed down by the full bench on 7 December 2020, save for those portions which are favorable to the applicants, including the punitive and or personal cost orders. And the parts that's favorable is the application to strike out where the court found in favor of the public protector in relation to utterances made by Minister Godan. If you go to page 15 of the document, and you will know that last week I took you through. Actually, I want to go to paragraph 30. Go up, it would be the PDF. Yeah. Right. Last week, we took you through the IGI report, and I haven't taken you through to the judgment yet, but I do want to point to you that in the application for leave to appeal, an affidavit, the point that was made to the appeal court, and the only point in relation to the IGI report is the subsequent or ex post facto setting aside of the IGI report is irrelevant to the present proceedings. The Court Acquo's rejection of the submission that the report had not been reviewed at the time of the issuing of the public protector's report as meritless is in the circumstances a gross misdirection. There's no such thing as prophetic mootness. The IGI report had only been recently been set aside. At the time it was relied upon, it had not yet been set aside. So we now know from affidavit, the public protector in her affidavit and application for leave to appeal said that the IGI report at the time it was relied upon had not yet been set aside. Right? If you go into the judgment, go to the PDF page 140. And go to paragraph 7. So the bench hears argument on the application for leave to appeal, and it then writes a judgment in which it refuses leave to appeal. And this is what it has to say then. The respondents have not met this threshold, and this is the threshold as the test as to whether you must be granted leave to appeal. Whilst it is trite that an application for leave to appeal does not provide the parties with an opportunity to re-argue the matter, it is quite apparent from the heads of argument and submission made by the respondents' counsel that parts of the judgment they seek to appeal against have either been misinterpreted or misunderstood. And I'm going to take you, having covered with you in respect of when we talked about the CR 17 judgment, we spoke about the findings on the Executive Ethics Code in this judgment. We also spoke about the IGI and the costs. So I want to, in one go, take you through what the court said in respect of all of them. So let's go to paragraph 11 first. The manner in which the first respondent is capable of reaching conclusions which are unsupported by the facts and the law, a fact which supports the improper motive and biasness ground of review, is demonstrated when she deals with the applicable Executive Ethics Code in relation to the Ambani meeting. It is an irrefutable fact that the Executive Members Code 2000 does not punish inadvertent mistakes. Yet the first respondent states in the heads of argument that the finding that the applicable code does not punish inadvertent mistakes is incorrect. To start with, that was not the finding of this court as explained above. Yet the first respondent perpetuates this misunderstanding by stating the applicant is cognizant sick of the fact that unlike the 2000 version, the 2007 version of the Executive Ethics Code, the Executive Code reads thus, members of the executive may not willfully or inadvertently mislead the legislature to which they are accountable. The fact is that there is no 2007 version of the Executive Ethics Code, and this was conceded by counsel who represented the first respondent during the hearing of this matter, Mr. Masuku SC. According to Mr. Masuku, the first respondent had based the findings in this regard on a ministerial handbook. The repetition of the misunderstanding in an application for leave to appeal can only be described as astounding. It bears mentioning that the misunderstanding was the basis on which the first respondent recommended remedial action with potentially far-reaching consequences against Minister Kudan to the President. Go to paragraph 14, which deals with the IGI. In considering the establishment of the SARS unit, the first respondent relied on a number of reports produced by other institutions or public officials, such as the Inspector General of Intelligence. The prevarication and ambivalence of the first respondent regarding that part of the investigation raised serious concerns by the court. She was found to have been dishonest in that she claimed on the one hand that she had not seen the OIG report, but that she had relied on it in crafting the terms of remedial action. Later, she conceded that she was in fact in possession of the classified OIG report. That report has since been set aside entirely. The first and tenth respondents are appealing the court's findings that the first respondent's findings were irrational to the extent that she relied on the OIG high report. Go one page next. That's a little bit out of order. So page 8, yeah. Go down to page, go past page 8 and you'll find page 7. Just, yeah. They submit that the first respondent could not have possibly foreseen that the OIG report would subsequently be set aside. The court found in Dahlia that had the first respondent considered the OIG report properly and applied her mind diligently, as she was called upon to do, she would have established that the OIG report was a flawed document and that it was a product of ultra vires conduct on the part of the Inspector General of Intelligence. It is also common cause that those implicated in the OIGI report were not afforded a hearing in terms of the Hari Altram Patam principle, yet the 10th respondent argues that this issue was merely a factor to be considered by the first respondent in assessing evidence, and that it could not be fatal to our own report, and that it was therefore rational for the first respondent to have relied on the OIG report. In considering whether the first respondent had acted rationally regarding reliance on the OIG report, the court referred to the case of Democratic Alliance versus President of the Republic of South Africa, where the Constitutional Court held as follows. The conclusion that the process must also be rational, in that it must be rationally related to the achievement of the purpose for which the power is conferred, is inescapable. An inevitable consequence of the understanding that rationality review is an evaluation of the relationship between means and ends. The means for achieving the purpose for which the power was conferred must include everything that is done to achieve the purpose. Not only the decision employed to achieve the purpose, but But also everything done in the process of taking that decision constitutes means towards the attainment of the purpose for which the power was conferred. The facts in the OIG report were never tested, in that the affected persons were not granted the OID, and the reliance on those untested facts which constituted the report is irrational. And then on costs, the court ordered the first and second respondents to pay the cost of the applicants on the scale between attorney and client, and limited the personal liability 15% of the total cost. It was also held that the first respondent had acted in total disregard of the values enshrined in section 181, 1A and 182 of the Constitution, which called upon the first respondent to be impartial and to exercise the powers and perform her functions without fear, favor, or prejudice. The court found that this failure on her part warranted a personal and punitive cost order. The court found that the first respondent acted with blatant dishonesty and biasness, in that she ignored hard facts and evidence, thereby displaying a tendency to investigate with a preconceived notion. The court was, however, mindful of the previous decisions regarding the chilling effect of the cost orders on the scale appealed against, but was of the view that the facts of this case warranted such an order. It is strict that each case must be judged on its own facts, and that the admonition against the laissez-faire approach, such punitive cost orders ought not to put the steel armor against deserving persons where such orders are called for and are justifiable. Go down. And then it refers to the SARS judgment, which was the provincial judgment. Go down. No, the Constitutional Court judgment, sorry. Right. And then it says, the first respondent submits that there are other compelling reasons why the appeal should be heard, such as the interpretation of Section 6.9, 7.9, and 9 of the Public Protector Act. There is a pending case between the President and the Public Protector before the Constitutional Court in which Section 7.9 will be considered. For each of Section 6.9 and Section 9, there are no less than two decisions of the full bench of this court which have made consistent findings of what these sections mean and how they operate. There is therefore no further clarification needed in that regard from the appellant courts, and no public interest will be served by an appeal in respect to which there is no legal uncertainty. Go down. In the circumstances, I am not persuaded that another court would come to a different conclusion, and then the full bench refuses application for leave to appeal. That is upheld by the SCA. There, and then there's an application for leave to appeal to the Constitutional Court. Shep will just go to 8.1 in the bundle. So we know that the leave to appeal was two judges of the SCA, Wallace and Morthley, in September 2001, refused leave to appeal. Leave was, reconsideration was then sought by the Judge President Meyer on 28th January 2022, who then refused such a reconsideration. And then they go to the Constitutional Court. And in paragraph 36 of the application, it says that it is, in my view, there's a word missing of the above. It is in view of the above that I submit it's a conclusion, actually, with respect that I'm constitutionally mandated to conduct investigations when I'm confronted with a complaint, including a complaint that exceeds the prescribed two-year period in order to establish the presence of exceptional circumstances. So the public protector tells the Constitutional Court that she must investigate in order to establish the presence of exceptional circumstances. In paragraphs 39 to 45, she deals with the unlawful establishment of the so-called rogue unit. And says that it is common cause that the unit was established within SARS during Mr. Godin's tenure as SARS commissioner around February 2007. Despite the fact that neither the SARS Act nor the SARS Amendment Act refers to objectives of SARS as a covert gathering of information or establishment of an intelligence unit. And then there's a jump that says that it is in view of the above that Mr. Godin and SARS correctly deemed it necessary to conclude an MOU with the NIA and to request that the then Minister of Finance provides funds specifically for a unit which would be operated by the NIA because SARS did not have a legislative mandate. And then they rely on this memorandum that demonstrates that at the time of establishing the unit, Mr. Godin was cognizant of the fact that SARS did not have a legislative mandate for the establishment of the aforesaid unit within SARS and therefore required the cooperation of the NIA. Reliance is then placed on Section 205 of the Constitution. Godin. Again, and then they deal with the memorandum concluded between NIA and SARS was because of a statutory limitation. And she then says to the knowledge, let me rather read 43 out before I misrepresent it. Sorry, let me do that. It is therefore apparent that the memorandum concluded between the NIA and SARS was because of the statutory limitations on SARS against establishing its own intelligence unit and capacity of the kind which was envisaged. It is in view of the above that I submit with respect that the public protector was justified in concluding the investigations which revealed that Minister Godin established the aforesaid unit in spite of being well aware of the fact that SARS did not have the competency to carry out the intended intelligence gathering activities, which is plainly unlawful. To the knowledge of the respondents, the remedial action I issued was duly implemented to the extent that the intelligence agency and SARS arranged for the delivery of equipment used by the so-called road unit back to SA with the participation of the public protector. And this committee received a letter from Commissioner Kieswetter in respect of that equipment, which the committee would be familiar with the contents. I therefore submit that with respect, the court are co-erred in making a finding to the effect that no intelligence unit was established by Minister Godin at SARS during his term as SARS commissioner. They deal in paragraphs 46 to 48. Public protector says that none of these reports, except for the OIGI report, have been set aside by a court of law. The OIGI report was only set aside long after the public protector had published the report, which is the subject matter of this case, and even then the merits thereof were not considered during the setting aside of the same. Go down. It is therefore perfectly reasonable and rational for the public protector, having conducted their own independent investigation, to also rely on these reports in the circumstances. So she and the court are co-erred in finding that the public protector took consideration of irrelevant considerations and relied on discredited reports. So that's what the court said. What you don't find and what you may want to ask the public protector when she comes and gives the evidence is, where on appeal did she allege to the appeal courts that the High Court erred in any factual finding which it had made in its judgment, as has been raised before this committee? Chair, I want to take you to two further documents. If you look at Shepo, pull up the document called comparison. On the stick. It's called comparison table.
Can we use that and take 10 minutes break whilst you're checking that? Okay, we'll take 10 minutes to break. Thank you.
Recording stopped.